during the 1950s, the huddled peoples of the world invested their hopes and their nation's destinies in a series of great heroes, glamorous, charismatic men who would somehow wrench them out of their poverty and out of their lack of power and bring them into the new day. There was Sukarno in Indonesia, Nkrumah in Ghana, Kenyatta in Kenya, Ben Bella in Algeria, Ayub Khan in Pakistan, Nasser in Egypt, Castro in Cuba, and many others. And then during this last decade, during the 1960s, the peoples of the world, the dispossessed, lost faith in these messianic pretenders. One by one, the men on the white horse were knocked off of the saddle. Their offices were stripped from them. People lost their faith in instant paradise. They recognized that for the underprivileged nations of the world to develop, schools had to be built and classes had to be taught and dispensaries had to be raised and doctors had to be trained and roads had to be built and cities had to be made amenable and people had to be taught the new skills of the 20th century, that thousands and tens of thousands of tasks had to be performed, and that no magician with his magic wand could simply wave that wand and instantly bring about the new dawn. And so, with the exception of Castro and Nasser, all of these messianic figures lost their offices, and even these two end the century with their image as Sir Galahad greatly tarnished. Because one cannot deal day by day with the routines of office holding, with sugar crop productions and the miles of sewage lines that need to be laid, with the needs to bring in foreign capital and to have a decent balance of trade and maintain the image of a messiah. And so as the 1960s ended, we found ourselves in a far more utilitarian and realistic world than we had 10 years before. During the 1950s, people had dreamed utopian visions. They had looked forward to the great end of colonialism, freedom. They looked forward to the dispossession of the traditional privileged classes and castes who had for so many generations raked off the economic surplus of their nation. During the 1960s, these same peoples discovered that one could have freedom from a European power only to be subjected to a native power, to a junta of colonels, or to some local strongman. And that when one dispossessed the privileged class, one temporarily drained the country of its most highly trained manpower and of its one resource of risk capital, and one had to go hat in hand, begging abroad, for foreign aid, for skilled professionals, for the men and the materiel which alone make advancement possible. We end then its last decade, more realistic, perhaps even cynical. The utopian dreams have been shattered, and the world looks forward towards a slower, more slowly built progress. The cult of personality, which is the inevitable byproduct of messianic dreams, disappeared during the 1950s. How many of us can name offhand Sukarno's successor in Indonesia, or Nkrumah's successor in the Ghana? They were Suharto and Ankara, faceless names, little more. Names of the bureaucrats who were managing the apparatus of government. Not the names of great national heroes who were leading a united people into the new dawn. And interestingly, what was true of the underdeveloped nations was true equally of the industrial nations of the West, the Soviet, and of the United States. It has been generally true since the Second World War that the pace of development, that the rate of progress at political life among the have nations, the great nations of Western Europe, the great superpowers of the world, has been radically different than those of the underdeveloped nations. But in this one respect, the developed nations and the underdeveloped nations were of a kind. Khrushchev was deposed in 1964. He was something of a peasant, something of a boor, but he had style, he had power, he had a flair, he had personality. One recognized him, one knew what he stood for. And he was succeeded by the duo of Brezhnev and Kosygin, best described as apparatchiks, unknown men who somehow climbed up the slippery ladder of success in the Soviet bureaucracy, faceless men whose policies, whose minds, whose personalities somehow didn't come through. General de Gaulle had towered over his nation for most of the past 20 years. Georges Pompidou was a shadow someplace at his side. And he remains a shadowy figure even now when he has taken de Gaulle's place as the president of the Fourth Republic. Mr. Wilson is irascible but hardly irresistible. He reminds us of a British country squire ruling the peasantry. He's hardly a world figure of gigantic heroic proportions. And even Mr. Nixon fits best into the category of these men who govern but who cannot galvanize, who have power but have little magnetism or electricity. The cult of personality seems to be ended. And this is not necessarily a retrogressive step, because as our Bible long since reminded us, al tiftachu bini divim, don't put your trust in the great messianic figures and the great demagogic leaders and those who promise you the day after tomorrow today. Messianic figures have a way of seeking power, some of them simply for the enjoyment of power, and others seek power simply to build up their family's bank accounts in Switzerland. And even the best of them, and the most honest and honorable, inevitably add to the frustration and the disappointment of their people, because they raise high the hopes, the futile hopes, the impossible hopes, and the fall is all the more precipitous, and the gall that one must drink after the fall all the more bitter. The cult of personality lay shattered. Men recognized that there was no instant paradise, and the proof of this came very early in the last decade when Mao Tse-tung's attempt at the great leap forward, instant success, had to be called off in 1961 because the Chinese peasantry simply wouldn't be moved that far from its traditional clan and village base. You can't force people to march even with the most ferocious autocratic power state can muster. To march too far, too fast. They'll balk. They remain people, and not numbers in a five-year plan. And interestingly, as we look back at the last 25 years, the years since the end of the Second World War, only one nation in the world has made it from a pre-industrial status, without its machines, without modern agriculture, without a modern technological infrastructure, into the 20th century. And that nation is Israel. And Israel has had a series of particular and special advantages going for her. The influx of a highly trained, Western-trained manpower, and the influx of risk capital, of Western capital. But Israel alone, among all the 80 underdeveloped nations of the world, has made it into a mass consumption society, to the industrial status. And for the other nations, the gap between modern technology and modern industry on the one side and primitivism and poverty and penury on the other has, if anything, widened and grown. And so it was that the 1960s ended on a far more realistic, utilitarian basis than they had, in fact, begun. The cult of personality was shattered except in one nation in the world, in the People's Republic of China. And there the cult of the leader, the cult of Mao Tse-tung, was rampant, was at ebb tide. Mao's picture was everywhere. The little red book was clutched in every hand, and the maxims of the little red book of the master were on every lip. And I think one could make the case that the most portentous event of the last decade occurred on the 12th of October in 1964, when the scientists of the Chinese army exploded a low-yield atomic device in a test range in Sinkiang province. For now, the imperial ambitions of the master were wedded to the ultimate power. I have an Eastern friend who said to me some months ago that as far as the Oriental world was concerned, the two most dramatic events of the entire century so far were the Chinese defeat of the Russian military power during the war, the Russian-Japanese War of 1903 and 1904, and 60 years later, the gaining by China of this of her atomic power. In both cases, it was an issue of color and of inferiority based on color. In both instances, the East was learning to say, we can match the West at her own game in terms of her own powers. And he said to me, you know, there's a direct psychological line between Admiral Togo's defeat of the Russian Navy outside of Sevastopol in 1904 and Pearl Harbor, and there can be a direct psychological line between the events in Sinkiang province, the new atomic technology of the Chinese, and some future military confrontation by China of the West. And certainly as the decade ended, both of the great superpowers, both of the great white powers of the world, the Soviet and the United States, were acting out of concern for this new Oriental imperialism. During most of the decade, the Soviet Union and the United States were wondering which would be chosen as the ultimate enemy by the Chinese government. Between the Soviet and the Chinese, there were arguments about communist ideology. The Chinese were constantly accusing the Soviet of being revisionists, not true revolutionaries. There was the long disputed border in Manchuria and between Manchuria and Siberia. There was the struggle for control of the apparatus of the International Communist Party. And between the United States and China, there was the involvement in Vietnam. There was concern for who would get the economic privileges in Southeast Asia. There was a traditional ideological battle between free enterprise and communism. There were many issues at stake. And both of the superpowers hoped that the other would be selected by China as the most dangerous of enemy so that an alliance could be forged either between Peking and Moscow or between Peking and the West, which would throw the balance of power in the world dramatically into a new alignment. And so as the decade ended, we saw both Moscow and Washington moving heaven and earth to try to arrive at some arrangements with Mao's government. Mr. Kosygin had swallowed his pride, swallowed all the communist insults, swallowed all the attacks on the Russian embassies by the Chinese, and had gone to Peking and made some kind of compact with the Chinese government. And the United States government had swallowed its pride and announced the end of a 20-year attempt at embargoing Chinese trade, and announced our eagerness to engage in new kinds of cultural and newspaper interchange, hoping to find some kind of thaw in Chinese-American relationships. And I suspect that in the foreign ministries and the State Departments of both of these superpowers, there were men who were hoping desperately that when Mao died, and he is now 76, and that when his successors came into power, that his successors would be more like the faceless, the nameless, the bureaucrats who rule elsewhere in the world, that Lin Piao and Chu Enlai would be men who would have learnt well the lesson of the failure, both of the Great Leap Forward, and of the Cultural Revolution in the middle of the 1960s, with Mao's attempt at what he called a permanent revolution, and that they would concern themselves more with building up China's industry and her skills and her manpower and less on Chinese expansion and imperial ideals abroad. And there, I suspect, lies the political struggle which will be climactic during the 1970s. It's a struggle of color, it's a struggle of race, it's a struggle between the superpowers. It's a struggle which at this point may go in any one of many, many directions. The 1960s end. They were a time of realism, a time of nation building, a time of economic reorganization. They were anything but a revolutionary age. They were anything but an age of climactic and dramatic events. Indeed, if anything, it was an age in which freedom was constricted and restricted throughout our world. There were no new major social revolutions during the 1960s. In fact, in country after country, primitive attempts at some form of democratic social organization were shattered as some strong man or some group of colonels came in and took over the reins of government in the name of efficiency or of progress or of moving the nation forward. This was true in the Chad, it was true in Niger, it was true in Martinique, it was true in Costa Rica, it was true in Guatemala, it was true in Peru, it was true in Afghanistan, it was true in Iraq, it was true in Syria, it was true in many nations of the world. Freedom did not do well during the 1960s, and freedom did least well in the so-called socialist or revolutionary nations of our world. Czechoslovakia is perhaps the symbol of all that I'm saying. During the early part of this decade, though Czechoslovakia was still ruled by the Stalinist Novotny, his rule was slowly atrophying. He was becoming less and less restrictive. Doors were opening to the West. Czech writers were beginning to visit in Western capitals to speak what was on their mind. And then in January of 1968, Mr. Novotny was deposed and Mr. Dubček came to power. And suddenly the new breath of freedom was breathed throughout Czechoslovakia. The doors were open and people began to write openly of their feelings. People began to experiment openly with other forms of social and economic organization than the purely communist. And Russia found that she could not tolerate this kind of freedom, this kind of easy political alliance and free expression of ideas. The Czech leaders were summoned to Chierna, and then they were summoned to Moscow. And when they would not completely capitulate in August of 1968, 8 months after this great democratic socialist attempt was undertaken, the Red Army tanks and those of the Warsaw Pact nations crashed into Czechoslovakia, and the great experiment was over. The papers were censored. Those who wrote freely in the public press were arrested. Czechoslovakia was in effect broken up into two Soviets, one Czech and one Slovak. The sense of nationhood was denied her, and Czechoslovakia slipped back into that grayness, that authoritarian orthodoxy, which has been the way of life in Eastern Europe since the end of the Second World War. And what was true in Czechoslovakia was true in Poland, where under General Moczar and others, the Gomułka government moved more and more towards suppression, where every intellectualist, westernized idea was declared to be revisionist, generally declared to be Zionist and Judaic. An anti-Semitic campaign of major proportions was undertaken, as I've said to you before, in the Polish nation. And Poland was a country supine by the end of the decade under the most rigid of censorships and of autocratic regimes. And all this, of course, emanated from the Soviet Union. During the early years of the century, under Mr. Khrushchev, there had been some lessening of censorship, some freedom for the Russian intellectual. And then with Kosygin and Brezhnev, all of this freedom was suddenly withdrawn. The right to protest, the right of appeal was suddenly denied. It became more and more clear that one had to hew exactly to the party line. And again, we saw, as we had in the late 40s and early 50s, Russian writers flee to the West, Russian writers being sent to Siberia for having expressed themselves with too great freedom. And what was true in the Soviet nations was true equally in the Third World nations, in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, Algeria. These countries, which during the 1950s had proclaimed a social revolution, found during the 1960s that their leaders were more and more directing their economies towards imperial or expansionist undertakings, and even more, within the country. Anyone who said, but you're spending our butter on guns, you're wasting our schools in a vain attempt to gain vengeance on Israel or on the French or on someone else, anyone who raised his voice was imprisoned. There was little freedom. There was a strong man. There was the military junta. There was the prison. And in Iraq, there were the gallows for those who dissented. The 1960s, then, were not a time of freedom. Indeed, in the cradle of democracy, in Greece, we saw in 1967 the overthrow of a constitutional monarchy by a group of young and middle-aged colonels and the imposition of a reactionary, jail-centered, military-oriented regime which remains in power in Greece till this day. And perhaps most disturbing of all, as one looked at the entire world, was the observation made by Dr. D.M.B. Miller, who was a professor of international relations at the Canberra National University in Australia, who has written a very important paper on the ideology of the underdeveloped nations, in which he has said this, that one must not assume that the rhetoric of Franz Fanon, or the martyrdom of Che Guevara, or even the little red book of Mao, represents the wave of the future in these nations. That socialism and democracy and revolution and anti-colonialism are simply rhetoric. That the reality is that these nations are caught in a vice. The vice of poverty, the vice of illiteracy, the vice of being underdeveloped in terms of their human resource as well as their natural resource. That they will be constantly subjected to all kinds of pressure from within and from without. And that there are in each of these nations a growing division between the haves and the have-nots. We have tended to think of the division between abundance and affluence on the one side and ignorance and poverty on the other as between the Western nations and the underdeveloped nations. Dr. Miller has suggested that it exists within each of these nations themselves. He says that you can see it when you visit. You go to the capital, you go to the great city, and you see a Western city. Tall skyscrapers, open streets, bookshops, all that we're used to in the West. But you go outside the city, you find the slums, and beyond the slums, you find the primitive villages and the tribes. That in these countries of Africa and Asia and Latin America, 85% of the people still live largely as they lived a generation or two before, except that they now have the transistor radio, they now can visit the city, they now have expectations and hopes which disturb their ignorance and their innocence, but that there is within each nation a small group, a newly privileged group, a group which has been trained in technological ways, a group which understands what the new world is about, a group which can jet within a few hours to any part of the world and feel at home there. And that this division between the haves and the have-nots is perhaps the most dangerous of all which exists in the world. Because those who have the skills, the power, and the wealth want certain things to happen in their country and give it certain priorities. Economic development, urbanization, the guarantee of their own privileges. And the problems of poverty, the problems of disadvantage, the problems of what happens to personality as it is brutalized by this kind of exploitation, the problems which we have struggled with relative lack of success in our own democracy, these problems are problems which they will increasingly push aside and turn away from as unsolvable. And when people talk of freedom, of democracy, of the vote, they will see this as a threat to their rule. And more, he predicts, you're going to see a union of the governmental bureaucrat and technocrat, of the military officer, who is himself a bureaucrat and a technocrat, imposing their authority through some kind of undemocratic government on these nations throughout the world. And he certainly, based on the history of the last decade, can make an effective case for that proposition. The lights of freedom then did not burn brightly during the 1960s. The light of revolution was tarnished. The light of freedom was dimmed. Indeed, the only place in the world where freedom tended to be talked about and where men tended to talk of revolutionary action in order to enlarge freedom was in our own nation. The United States seemed to be in an anomalous position during the 1960s. As people experienced the revolution elsewhere in the world, they became disillusioned about it. But here, surrounded by abundance, in the midst of affluence, there were many who for the first time began to talk with the ideology of the revolution, ideology of radical change, talking about a major reconstitution or reconstruction of our governmental forms. For the first time in 30 years or more, reform was out of style as the American way of life, and many began to insist that only revolutionary changes could bring America back into the mainstream of her own development. Abundance is part of the explanation. We were fat, we were self-satisfied, and our abundance protected us from an awareness of the implications of revolutionary overthrow. We thought we could have a revolution in our sport cars too. We thought we could have radical reconstruction of government and all of the cultural advantages and social advantages we have enjoyed heretofore. And of course, the major part of the new birth of radicalism in America grows out of the mea culpa, the great sense of guilt which overrides and overshadows our national life. Guilt at our inability to solve the problems of race, to move forward effectively towards seeing people as human beings, making war on poverty, granting all peoples their right in the American sun, and our guilt at Vietnam, perhaps the most tragic single blunder, compounded blunder, in all of our political history. Vietnam had not only cost some 35,000 casualties, some $200 billion of dollars in treasure. Vietnam had not only aborted the Great Society and the Fair Deal before the economic legislation which was devised had been given a chance to operate. The war in Vietnam had not only aborted the war on poverty and made it into a sham and into a farce, but the war in Vietnam had rutted and gutted the very moral fiber of the nation. We were no longer proud of our traditions. We were somewhat cynical about the professions of those who govern. We had little faith one meant what one said, that the historic commitment of this nation towards progress and towards freedom and towards human dignity in our own nation and throughout the world seemed to be sham and hypocritical. The war in Vietnam is going to go down, I'm afraid, in history as one of the tragic turning points in our nation's life. And so as this decade ended in the United States, we found young and middle-aged alike speaking the words, insisting on radical reconstruction, on revolutionary change, somewhat innocent, I must confess, in their statements, eager to have a better America, eager to have a more peaceful world, but rather single-minded and simplistic in the way in which these were to be achieved. And in this respect, America seemed to be out of step with the world. The world was becoming more realistic. America was becoming far more simplistic. We called it idealism, but really it was innocence and simplicity. Many of us have on the bumpers of our cars the little slogan, "War is bad for children and other living things." The war in Vietnam moves us to join a peace movement, moves us to demand the ultimate and immediate withdrawal of our troops from this jungle morass, this stupid war. The war in Vietnam moves us to reconsider our attitude towards the military as an instrument of political activity. But the war also moves many to a kind of romantic attack on the defense establishment itself, on the use of force, on the necessary place of force in an imperfect world. We find the peace movement shading into total pacifism. We find the ultimate anomaly of young men refusing on pacifistic grounds to serve in the United States Army, fleeing to Sweden, which spends more per capita on our military establishment than any other nation in Western Europe, looking upon Sweden as the great refuge for the principled today. What I'm saying is simply this. We live in a world which must wrestle with the most awesome and complex of economic and political problems mankind has ever known. And there's a bomb ticking away, a time clock. We're under the gun, the atomic gun and the population gun. The world must bestir itself as never before to get out of the rut of greed, to pull itself above selfishness, to dedicate its wealth, its talent, to the solution of these social problems. But they will not be solved by any panacea. Peace will not come to the world when one nation or one group simply lays down its arms and refuses to serve. What will probably come is Czechoslovakia, the imposition by the aggressive of their authority on the passive. The history of the radical movements of the revolutionary governments in our decades suggest that though they may lead some nations to be more energetic in achieving economic freedom, they inevitably destroy what vestigial freedoms remain in that country itself. And if we want freedom and economic progress, then we must hold on to such freedoms as we have, and we cannot simply give in to the bully. We live, dear friends, in a dangerous time. We have reason to know again the biblical promise. Messianic promise, b'acharit hayamim, at the end of days, at the end of the tunnel, not today, not tomorrow, not next year, but 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years perhaps from now. For us, the decade ahead is bleak and full of obligation and full of duty. If we continue as we have continued to get, to demand, to aggrandize, to be concerned only with our immediate environment and our immediate advantage, if we continue as we have been to be concerned only with the rights of those of our own color or our own ethnic background or our own national passport, if we continue to be involved only with the particular paycheck which we receive or the particular needs of the union or of the industry of which we are a part, if we remain in the kinds of patterns which have been traditional heretofore, we will find when the 1970s end that the report we will have to make will not only be of the diminishing of the revolutionary fervor, of the idealistic element in life, and of the reduction of the light of freedom, but that there will have been reaction and repression, if not war, throughout our world. As the decade ended, Daniel Moynihan observed someplace that to him the tragedy of the 1960s was not simply that men were incapable of meeting the immediate problems which confronted them, that they knew what was needed, but continued to waste the national treasure on imperial ambitions, on war, on vengeance, on maintaining a cadre or a class or a group in power. But to him, the ultimate tragedy of the 1960s is that for the first time in history, the men who were in power, power in the nations of the world and power over the culture of the world, knew that they did not know what was needed. Because along with all of these political events, he suggests, men during the 1960s lost their faith in the ultimate and elemental moral traditions of mankind. Their faith in human decency, their faith in the collective, their faith in human freedom, their faith in due process, their faith that mankind, by respecting the means, can achieve the desired ends. We became a cynical lot. We became the managers of industry and the bureaucrats of government, and we did what was set for us. We became very indulgent in our own lives. We became very grasping. What works for us is valid. Since the Second World War, we have seen a steady confusion in mankind's appreciation or understanding of the elemental and basic values which must guide the human race. Words have poured out from all sources and from all sides. Words which tell us that there are no moral standards, that there are no ethical absolutes. Words which tell us that everything is permitted. Well, everything cannot be permitted, because that's hefkerut. That's not only social confusion, but that's stagnation for the race. There are standards of decency and rectitude and righteousness and justice and responsibility and community. And men cannot violate these standards with impunity. And if we do, if we say we are clear-eyed and we are cynics or realists, and we know that the moral standards are simply imposed by priests or by the ruling classes upon others, whatever the rationalization we adopt, if we adopt this cynical attitude, let us recognize that what will happen during the 70s and in the 80s is simply this. The greater and greater power will aggrandize to those who manage the bureaus of government, the military, the great industrial complexes, and that they will have no guide, no measure by which they are to judge the social or national interest. Their interest and their responsibility is simply to the bureau, to the machine, to the apparatus which they manage, and that ultimately there must be confrontation. Not the confrontation of demonstrator with the police, but the confrontation of national juggernaut with national juggernaut, of economic privilege with economic privilege. Out of that can come only repression, can come only war. Dor ba v'dor yashab. One decade ends, another decade begins. But the word of the Lord endures forever. We've forgotten that simple truth. We speak it. Sounds easy to say, but most of us do not really mean it. The word of the Lord, vague. What does it mean? What does it require of me? What's involved? The word of the Lord endures forever. These commandments, thou shalt not. Thou shalt not tread on another person's privileges unless they are detrimental to the social good. Thou shalt not speak falsehood. Thou mayest not give over responsibility to thy life, to any establishment, to any industry, to any business, to any profession. You are ultimately responsible. Thou shalt respect yourself, your parents, and your family, and your community. You shall not arrogate privilege to yourself, nor be contemptuous of those who are seeking to do what you are doing, but do it in another way. Righteousness thou shalt pursue, and justice thou shalt seek. The words, we know their meaning. We don't want to hear sometimes. But we know. One generation comes, another generation goes. The word of the Lord endures forever. Amen.